Hello and welcome to Civility and Solutions, a podcast brought to you by your Court Services section of the Supreme Court of Ohio. I am your host, longtime justice enthusiast, Kate Munger. This is a podcast about inspirational ideas for courts from across our 88 beautiful Ohio counties. Today's topic relates to dispute resolution for workplace conflict. If you are a manager or in court leadership, today's topic will certainly interest you. We'll talk about the cost of unresolved workplace conflict. We'll also consider instances in which some workplace conflict can be beneficial. Listeners will hear some best practices for preventing disruptive workplace conflict and for resolving existing conflicts in an effective manner to improve office dynamics. The views expressed by guests to this podcast don't necessarily express the views of the Supreme Court. We are happy to be able to use this platform to share solutions and challenges with courts and any listeners who want to stay on the cutting edge of dispute resolution and court services issues. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 18. Our topic is dispute resolution for workplace conflict, when we can't all just get along. Joining me today is Kimberly Vanover Riley, Esquire. Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Kim, you've created such an interesting specialization. You are an expert at employment and civil rights cases, and you assist Ohio judges in maintaining compliance with the law. How did you get interested in this intersection of human resources and courts?
Completely by accident. I started working with the law firm that I am still practicing with now while I was still in law school. And since that time, our firm has been representing the judiciary long ago through a policy of insurance procured by the Supreme Court, and today through a self-insurance program. So it's a pretty great intersection of those two things, because I sort of pride myself on being a big nerd about the law and about government, and also love employment law. So they fit together nicely, and it creates some very unique issues that you probably don't see in a lot of other employment environments, but it also, there are a lot of dynamic truths that I think apply across all sections of workplaces, and especially all government workplaces.
And your law firm is called Montgomery Johnson LLP. Can you tell us a bit about your law firm? What kind of other cases does your firm handle, and what are the strengths of your firm?
Great question. We're actually an offshoot of a firm that had been around a good deal longer. We're actually only in our second, I guess we're entering our third year now. And the majority of my partners and other colleagues engage in this kind of work. We represent other state and local government entities in employment and civil rights matters. I have other partners who do work that has no resemblance to mine whatsoever, which is nice when you've got issues that you think, how would someone who doesn't operate in this universe regard the same set of facts that I'm seeing? So that works out nicely. We have folks who do asbestos and product liability and general litigation matters that don't kind of approach anything what I do. But for the most part, I'd say more than half of my colleagues do exactly this kind of work. So, and one of the things that I think makes our dynamic especially good is that we genuinely like each other, which is not something I always hear. We've all been working together for, gosh, I started there when I was still in law school in 1990, goodness, this is going to date me, beginning of 1996. And I still practice with a bunch of people who were there even before I was. So we've got a few new people, but a lot of people who just, we can't get to leave because we all actually enjoy showing up. So we're going to be talking a lot today about shared history and shared dynamics and sort of institutional dynamics and a history and pattern of shared behaviors that can sometimes help or hinder keeping a workplace running smoothly. I think we're a good example of how, you know, the things that you find endearing about your colleagues are sometimes because they've been doing it the same way for the last 25 years. And sometimes the things that are not so endearing are because they've been doing the same things for 25 years. I tend to be very fortunate that my colleagues do a lot of things that I find that I enjoy for that length of time. So
you are also a certified instructor in human resources for the National Center for State Courts Institute for Court Management and an Ohio State Bar certified specialist in labor and employment law. And I know you've trained hundreds of judges and court administrators on workplace issues, including being a regular instructor for the Supreme Court's Judicial College. What is it about educating people that you like? And do you have tips for someone who is training a group of bosses?
You know, I find that training people who are on the ground of these issues tend to be very receptive to receiving training because they're very thirsty to get information to help make this job easier. I think it's not what anybody who gets into, you know, one of the things we always say when we're training new judges is nobody got into this gig to be an employer. People pursued that work because they were interested in becoming a judge, and they are often very surprised to find how big the job of overseeing the personnel and the operational end of the office ends up becoming. And it's not necessarily the part of the job they enjoy the most. And so finding good managers who can take some of that responsibility and run with it so that you can do the things that you actually were elected to do. And that's not just true of courts. I think most people probably do not gravitate toward this as their kind of highest ideal part of the job. So I really don't have a whole lot of challenge getting managers to show up and come up with things to want to find out, because they usually come to me with a series of challenges that they're looking to work through. But it's a very exciting opportunity. I always love being able to work on the preventive end, because all too often in litigation, we're sort of, by the time you can solve an issue, you're putting a Band-Aid on a broken leg. So being able to actually get ahead of these crises before they start or interrupt them before they spiral out is probably the most satisfying part of my job, because it's far, far more fun to prevent and to fend off those crises rather than sort of try to compensate everybody after it's all finished.
Well, and speaking of crises, you defend disciplinary matters before the Ohio Board of Professional Conduct, and that has to be stressful work at times. How do you help your clients through those kind of cases?
Those can be very different. I mean, in the circumstances that lead to an investigation or to a case even being prosecuted are as varied as the day is long. So they can arise out of personnel issues. They can arise out of things that happen in people's private lives. So it really depends on the circumstance. But when it comes to the personnel matters, in particular, one of the kind of guiding principles of preventing claims that arise in those categories of matters and kind of putting those things to rest are going to be employing a lot of the same principles we're talking about in how to avoid unhealthy disputes in the workplace, how to avoid disputes that can turn into litigation as well. They all tend to feed off the same categories of dysfunction that we see when cases progress to litigation.
All right. Well, are you ready to start in on talking about workplace conflict, our topic today?
I was born ready. Let's do it.
Well, I think it's definitely a topic everyone can relate to, because we've all been at workplaces where certain personality types can cause conflict. And you've identified some certain personalities that can cause issues. What are those?
Well, this is only a brief sampling. I'm sure there are far more. If I were to sort of line up and think about all of the managers and public officials that I've defended in employment lawsuits, or the plaintiffs who have brought those lawsuits, or the kind of parties who were in various disputes that preceded lawsuits, they would fall into a few categories. And I'm sure this is just a limited sampling, but probably the most predominant dysfunctional, and maybe these aren't personality types, maybe people are perfectly lovely in most respects, and these are just dysfunctional dynamics that have evolved between different people. We've sort of shorthanded these as like the science fair volcano personality type, where you've got two different people who are completely capable of doing their jobs well, getting along with others, but you've got one who is vinegar and one who is baking soda. And when they come together, it is the volcano that continually erupts. They're just combustible when you put them in the same job together, the same room together, the same projects together. And it's not that those things can't be worked out, but we often will see that where we'll hear, this person's perfectly lovely with every other person, but they just have an ongoing clash with this one coworker. We also see kind of the rock star, the headliner types who are high performers and very well regarded. And especially in public service, I tend to see people who maybe had a pre-existing relationship with the elected judge, and they may have come into the job mm-hmm. from private sector, having worked with that judge for years in a private law firm or in a prosecutor's office. And then they come into a court with a bunch of pre-existing employees who already have sort of a working dynamic. And not only are they new and have different approaches to things, but they sort of walk in with the expectation that I know the judge is the one in charge, but I'm really the I get to listen to.
I think that happens a lot.
You see that a lot. We see a lot of kind of turf war sort of dynamics arising early into especially single judge court administrations. And I think that dynamic extends across a variety of different public sector and private sector workplaces as well. And then, you know, I'm sure every workplace has kind of unhealthy dynamics that can arise from disagreements over, it's not my job, it's your job, that's not in my job description. You know, when you've got people who really are not wired to be team players or who are clock watchers and think, okay, well, that's really nice that you're in the midst of a crisis, but it's 4:29 and I'm out of here in 1 minute. So I hope that, you know, if there's anything you'd like me to do in the next 60 seconds, I'm all yours. but other than that, I'll see you tomorrow. We also can see people who are a little more devious in terms of manipulating or kind of puppeteering what's happening. And it doesn't appear that way to the people in charge. I mean, often I'll be defending employment lawsuits or I'll be investigating a matter for an employer. And the employer's perception of who is really kind of operating in good faith and doing a good job is not the same as when I start talking to staff and hearing that person has the manager's ear or that person has the boss's ear, but let me tell you what kind of nonsense is happening that is completely unknown to management that is really sort of driving a lot of the friction in our office. So mm-hmm. we also see sort of those dynamics playing out, probably less so in the last year, especially with the pandemic, and hopefully less so with a lot of the advances in the Me Too movement. We've had a long-standing history of dealing with the, you know, I'm just a hugger personality type, or the comedian, or the person who is maybe well-intentioned in trying to kind of forge a enjoyable work climate and ends up doing just the opposite by either oversharing personal information or making inappropriate jokes or not respecting personal space. I think, you know, it'll be interesting to me. There's so many things that are interesting to me about how workplace dynamics are likely to change in the next several years, owing to the fact that many of us have been completely interrupted from our regular work environments for the last year. But I have not, I'm trying to think if I've had a single workplace harassment issue bubble up in the past year, and I'm not sure I have, which is great.
No blues and no workplace harassment.
A little distance and distancing has, mm-hmm. has aided that dynamic, and it'll be interesting to see if we're able to continue it. So, oh gosh, I mean, there are, I'm sure everyone has experienced some other personality types that can cause difficulty.
We used to have mean girls at one of my old workplaces. We called them the mean girls. They were so toxic to the whole workplace. They're so mean.
Absolutely. Yes. The telegram, telephone, telekaren, you know, whatever, you've got the person who is sort of the unofficial pipeline of information that can definitely be a category that can cause a lot of difficulty. And often I'll find that it's the silly stuff like that we think, I can't believe I'm sitting here in a mediation or in the middle of a lawsuit because someone excluded someone else from a lunch invitation. And yet those kinds of dynamics can absolutely feed a lot of the very expensive, very unpleasant conflicts that we end up navigating. Gosh, I'm trying to think what other sort of dynamics that we tend to see, especially in the last year. I think there's always been a bit of an issue to watch about employees being concerned that they're doing more work than other people. In the public sector, especially, where pay grades may be set by seniority or set by certain pay grades, where it's not as fluid as it might be in the private sector. It's also extremely accessible information in the public sector, whereas it might not be in the private sector about how much different people are earning. I tend to find that there's a lot more comparison about who's doing more, who's contributing less.
And especially with the work at home environment, probably, like, if you have to be in the office and some people get the opportunity to work at home, then are they doing anything? Or are they just like hanging out with their dog all day?
100%. And, I think that's a dynamic that has probably gotten worse in the last year, because I've gotten a lot of calls. We operate a hotline through the judges program where courts can call with sort of pre-crisis advice and say, I've got this issue and I need you to help us work through it. That's been a very chronic issue, is that there are people whose kids maybe are home from school or studying virtually. And so maybe an employee is getting their job done beautifully, but they're getting the majority of it done between the hours of 8 p.m. and 11 p.m. when the kids are in bed. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's fine with the employer and the employees don't see that. Or you may have an employee who has a disability and the employer is not allowed to share the details of certain accommodations that have been afforded to that employee. But to everyone else, it might just look like unfair treatment, or that someone's getting a benefit that they're not, and they are not privy to all of the underlying reasons that things may not be the same for them as it is for someone else. And so a lot of the comparison game can breed a lot of conflict in the workplace. And we often will counsel employers on the best way to try to deal with that in a way that stays within the confines of the law, when you're not allowed to discuss employees' confidential medical information with another employee. All of those things, I'm sure there are others for every kind of conflict or every lawsuit we've had. I could probably pick out three or four of these personalities and say, in hindsight, if we had addressed some of those issues, we might not be here, which is altogether often. I mean, I can't think of too many employment lawsuits that we've defended or too many near lawsuits that we've missed that haven't originally developed without one or more of these dynamics being at play.
So how big of a problem is workplace conflict? I mean, you're talking about lawsuits. Is it that bad?
Well, and not always, unfortunately, not, I think that's sort of the last sort of nuclear option. I would say the balance of my caseload, or the balance of where I spend my time, might be spent at least 50% of the time trying to avoid people advancing to litigation, giving employers advice on some of the things they can do to diffuse conflicts and to address difficulties. Certainly not all dysfunctional dynamics or conflicts arise to litigation. That's sort of often you don't see litigation without a prior unresolved conflict, which is one of the many reasons we care about this stuff. There are far, far bigger costs that extend beyond just litigation, though. I think if you look at every inefficiency that arises, every bit of dysfunction that causes bad feelings or retention difficulties, when people don't feel welcome or they don't feel appreciated, you're very unlikely to be able to keep your best performers because they don't feel like it's worth their while to remain there. So, addressing these conflicts has a lot of benefits that extends far beyond just preventing litigation.
So what are some common responses to workplace conflict that you've seen? And I'm sure some are more effective than others. You were just talking about like kind of ignoring it. I don't know if that is helpful.
Absolutely. And the other thing that's very difficult is that a workplace conflict does not arise in a vacuum, and it never remains in a vacuum. You're going to have, every new person who gets added to your workplace, every person who leaves, every condition that gets adjusted has a tendency to improve or exacerbate an existing conflict. I'm sure the last year and all the changes that came into play dramatically upended a lot of conflict. We probably had pre-existing conflicts that went away when people weren't having to spend face-to-face time all the time together, or when they were on staggered shifts, or even when their offices or their workspaces were physically separated to try to prevent people from getting sick. So, you know, how employers approach those dynamics a lot of the time changes because the conflict itself changes based on a whole lot of variables, sometimes intentional and implemented by the employer to affect the change. And sometimes not at all. Sometimes it's stuff like a pandemic that has a tendency, but I tend to see at least three different approaches to employers handling conflict. I think the most common and the most understandable certainly is to just not pay attention. And if you pretend it's not there, maybe your hope, I think often the expectation is if I ignore it, it will go away. I hear a lot of supervisors and managers and judges say, you know what, we're all grownups. I did not get into this business to be a kindergarten teacher. So they're adults, they're professionals. I expect them to work out their differences. And so I'm not going to get involved. It's not my business. You know, they're fighting over things that either are petty or don't even relate to the job. So I'm not going to address it. Sometimes that's okay. Often it continues and it becomes a bigger issue. It might have been better to address it earlier, but that's, I think, probably the most common dynamic I see is just to avoid. And that's easiest. It's also probably the most pleasant for the person who would otherwise have to intervene. So that's probably why. The second category would be sort of the authoritarian, sort of applying unilateral pressure from above. I had a judge I represented years ago who I have actually stolen this line and applied it in trying to deal with disputes between my children, which is you fix it or I'll fix it. And I like that little phrase because it's funny. Probably not a great one always to use in the workplace. I mean, there are certainly occasions where that's the exact message to convey. But actually, I believe the way that this manager relayed the message was you fix it or I'll fix it and you're not going to like the way I fix it. And I thought that was got the message across, but that can be effective. There are certainly times where you don't need to be the problem solver. You just need to have the people in the midst of that dynamic resolve their problems. Sometimes if they could have done that already, they would have, and they may not be asking management to intervene, but they may desperately need management to be more of a facilitator. Especially when the conflict arises from stuff involving their work and their allocation of duties or how the work is getting done. Third category I see also very common, also because it's easier and a little bit more fun, is a lot of triangulation. You know, not going to the people who are necessarily the cause of the problem or in the midst of the conflict, but going to everybody else and just sort of talking smack about them behind their backs, you know, what's going on between the two of them? And all that tends to do is sort of feed the drama and escalate those dynamics that are causing the issues in the first place. So that is very seldom, if ever, going to be the most effective way to handle it, unless you're maybe seeking advice from somebody or trying to get insights that will make you better prepared and effective at addressing that conflict as a manager. So I'd like to afford people the best possible assumptions about their intentions. So maybe that's what they're doing. Maybe it's not just gossip. Maybe it's actually trying to gather intelligence to be a better facilitator of
Navigating those dynamics. It's helpful. So we know that the common cost of workplace conflict is just being super annoyed by the problem person. And you can just complain to everybody else in your life outside of work about this problem person, and they're annoying everything and everybody around them. But what are some common costs of workplace conflict that employers might miss?
Oh, that is a great question. And the one that I think is lost on a lot of people whose tendency is to minimize or ignore a lot of these conflicts, or to write them off as sort of workplace drama or interpersonal problems that don't have anything to do with the workplace, so I'm not going to get involved. Probably one of the very biggest costs of this unresolved conflict is the diminution of effective work and work time being invested in getting jobs done. You know, for every moment that you are throwing your hands in the air and getting agitated with a coworker, you're not doing your job. And you're also missing out on a valuable opportunity to collaborate and to work more productively, to get more of that buy-in and that give and take with a colleague. So certainly the quality and the quantity of the work that needs to be getting done can get compromised. When we're in public service, I think that's an especially big deal. If we've got two deputy clerks who are warring about something, or they're fighting over who's doing more and who's doing less, and that plays out in front of members of the public, and it has a tendency to diminish people's view about the professionalism or the integrity of the work happening in the court, that's a really big deal. And that's, you know, not just an issue that is important for courts, but for all sort of factions of public service. We are often reminded by people that they are paying our salaries. We hear, I have heard to report that they hear this very often from people who come in as, you know, our taxes are paying your salary. So we certainly don't expect to see behaviors that would not be permissible in our workplace. So get it together. Also, I think morale and the group dynamic really suffers, which has a tendency to make work a less enjoyable place. That can affect retention. I think nobody ever truly says, oh, I love my job, I look forward to coming to work every day, when there is a regular and persistent amount of conflict that remains unresolved. I think the more collegial and collaborative and positive a work environment is, the likelier it is you're going to like the job. You can really dislike the work, but if the people you're working with tend to get along and tend to have each other's backs, that just makes for a better work environment. We lose a lot of attendance. You know, it's funny, in the last year through the pandemic, I've had a lot of employers report that people who've had FMLA leave certified for various chronic health conditions have had far fewer absences. And while initially that might have suggested to them that perhaps those certifications weren't so valid, it also in other instances made them think, well, maybe the work environment is what was contributing to those migraine headaches or those, you know, chronic digestive issues or the anxiety or the depression that was affecting people's productivity. And the fact that people who have been working in a more sort of isolated environment haven't had the same health issues when they're doing their work from home, and they're not as sort of right up in each other's faces, maybe that's just that they have a workplace dynamic issue. Maybe not. I mean, maybe you've got someone who coming to the office is in and of itself a stressor because of their commute or pressures at home or work-life balance issues. But a lot of the time it could be a function of dynamics in the workplace that weren't ideal even beforehand. Turnover is such a big deal, and not one that I think gets addressed or appreciated often enough. You know, we tend to think of staffing as sort of a necessary evil. Yes, we're going to have people leave, we're going to have to hire replacements, but we lose so much with each employee who does their job well. It's not just having to go find someone else. We lose all that time and all that institutional knowledge that the outgoing person had. We lose all the time we have to spend training the new person and filling gaps that we may not even realize are immediately there until after they've been working for a while. And we think, oh gosh, you didn't know that, I have to go back. And we also spend a lot of time and money in training and developing our staff to be part of our succession plan. And when kind of dysfunctional workplace dynamics lead to early departures and increased turnovers, that really costs us a lot of our investment. If you think about all of the places that we spend money as employers and invest our resources, our human capital, our people are really our biggest investment. And then the most obvious of all is people can sometimes advance into litigation. And that's not the most common or the most likely outcome of unresolved conflict, but you often don't see litigation. With that, it's definitely the worst.
It's so bad for everyone.
It is not pleasant. It's especially unpleasant when that happens and you still have employees who are working there. I mean, you know, a lot of employers sort of envision their worst case scenario is someone getting fired and then suing. It's like, oh no, your worst place dynamic is when you haven't fired them and they're still there and they sue, and you also are continuing to come into work every day with that person. So you know, these dynamics are ignoring it and hoping it will go away can sometimes be your very worst strategy for that reason.
So is all workplace conflict bad? How does an employer know when to step in?
Question. And one that is very hard to answer with a single response, because it's always going to depend on the dynamic. But I mean, the easy answer to your question is no. I think not all workplace conflict is bad. And in fact, sometimes ignoring the need for conflict or ignoring the need to have an unpleasant conversation really misses an opportunity to prevent a problem from arising. We see that certainly in all the areas where litigation can happen, in workplace harassment, in, you know, race discrimination and racial harassment cases, disability accommodations. I think over the last year, we're probably very likely to see a lot of unresolved people feeling like they're not being treated fairly. And if those issues aren't kind of confronted head on and we don't have sometimes uncomfortable conversations, we can actually have things become worse. So there is kind of a category of conflict that maybe we want to discourage from happening, or we don't, you know, we don't need to draw out every disagreement and, you know, call coworkers to the conference room table and say, okay, we're really going to get to the bottom of this issue about whose turn it is to bring in donuts every other Wednesday, if that's an office policy. You know, there are some issues where we can trust people to work out their differences. When something appears to be escalating to a point where it's having kind of bleeding into other areas of the workplace, that's an area where we may need to, as managers, invest some effort into working out that conflict and confronting it head on. When we see things happening that are arguably maybe violations of our workplace policy, even if they're not violations of the law, I mean, most acts of workplace harassment and discrimination as a matter of law don't start out as legally actionable events of harassment or discrimination. They start out as usually smaller and more benign acts of workplace policy that's been violated. The first time someone makes an inappropriate joke or a backhanded comment, or, you know, something that they intended in a way that was light or funny, or maybe it was a microaggression, who knows how they intended it, laughing or ignoring it, or, you know, just sort of sweeping it under the rug to avoid having an unpleasant conversation or making someone feel uncomfortable because you don't laugh at their joke that wasn't funny, in the moment might seem like it's avoiding conflict, but it actually tends to extend some tacit approval or send the message that this is okay. And so in a lot of environments, especially as the supervisors and managers, we have to be hypervigilant to those dynamics and stepping in. Certainly a huge conversation that's been happening over the past year, especially, is the extent to which race dynamics have been overlooked. You know, for years, we saw employers talk about, you know, the objective as being having a workplace dynamic that was free from race discrimination without really discussing what that means. And when our only bar is sort of compliance with the law, that's going to still leave a huge category of hurt feelings and exclusion and failure to address real differences in the workplace, leave that off the table and leave a wide variety of our coworkers and future coworkers feeling disenfranchised.
You might not be alienating those employees and creating turnover, and you didn't even know that was the reason. But I think people are on higher alert that that could be an issue in our workplaces now.
Absolutely. And, you know, the reason that we avoid those conversations, sometimes well-intentioned, I think a lot of supervisors have approached us saying, I have no idea how to broach this. And the last thing I want to do is open this can of worms and have it spiral out in a way that I don't feel professionally, or, you know, I don't have the expertise to know how to wrangle this. You know, the first time someone raises their hand and says, well, I just want to address this sort of systemic inequity that's been happening, or, you know, I feel like this category of employees hasn't been listened to or offered a voice at the table, that stirs up a lot of feelings of guilt and insecurity and, oh my gosh, I don't know how to handle this. And that doesn't mean it's a bad thing. And often, you know, the single biggest reason I think a lot of workplace conflict erupts is because people don't feel heard. They don't feel like their perspectives have been listened to. Mm-hmm. And that applies to a whole category of issues. But I think race and gender and disability, a lot of groups who have historically not been afforded an active kind of voice in these disputes, mm-hmm. we're seeing a greater willingness to engage in those uncomfortable conversations because of the overall benefit that it ultimately yields. It's mm-hmm. getting through that initial discomfort and having those conversations that can make things the most frightening. And it's the reason that there's a lot of reluctance, but getting everybody's willingness to sort of jump in and give each other a little bit of grace to have those conversations is really beneficial when you can pull it off.
That's great. And let's talk about some more best practices that you've developed for dealing with workplace conflicts. How do we prevent the conflict of race or any other conflicts, like from the very beginning? Are there ways that workplaces can put systems in place to address those issues before they become issues?
Different kinds of conflicts, I think, can be avoided in different sorts of ways. The ones that pertain to differences that really live inside and outside the workplace, things like systemic inequities with mm-hmm. race, with disability, with gender, those issues, I think, have a different and a much more difficult way of trying to avoid conflict from arising, because I think it is, people are carrying in an awful lot of baggage from outside the workplace that may need to be addressed, as well as things that are happening in the workplace. Let me start with the easier one.
Okay.
I think if we're trying to prevent avoidable and disruptive conflict that arises from the job, or people fighting over distribution of duties or how things get done or whose call it is about how we're going to do something in particular, employers have the most control over those things, and the kind of weapons in your arsenal are so easy to implement, and yet they don't consistently do them. I mean, my experience is in 90% or more of the litigation I defend, I'll go back and look to see what their job descriptions look like, how specific they've been about what their expectations are and preparing people for what they should be doing. Or I'll look at what kinds of conversations they had in the job interview about the culture and the climate of the workplace and what the expectations are. I look at the breadth of the training that was offered during onboarding and continuously about getting people to understand what the employer wanted from them as employees and as coworkers. And I will consistently find that there were things that could have been handled better to sort of get ahead of these issues. And sometimes you're never going to be able to anticipate the particular thing that creates division in your workforce. More often than not, though, that's not the case. If you're finding that you see workplace dynamics becoming complicated over the same things, that's a pretty good indicator that you need to be getting ahead of those issues with your workplace policies, with a lot of your written product, a lot of your training and orientation. The reason we don't do that stuff is that it's expensive, it's time consuming, it's kind of boring, unless you're, somebody who's a huge nerd about this stuff. But offering all of those tools at the onset really helps set the tone for here's how we do things here. And here's what is acceptable and not acceptable. If it's 429 and you've got a coworker who's in crisis, chances are we expect you to stick around and help them out, because we would expect them to do the same thing in your shoes when you're in that situation. So offering a lot of training on professionalism and civility. We used to look at workplace harassment training as sort of the benchmark for what employers needed to do. 20 years later, after the Ellerth and Barriger cases came out of the Supreme Court, and we've recently had a new revised code section that actually statutorily says that this training is something that affords employers an affirmative defense in those cases, we now see that as a baseline. I mean, that's sort of the bottom of the barrel expectation. What we're finding needs to be employed above and beyond that compliance training is specific training on workplace civility and professionalism that never is going to prevent. I mean, workplace harassment is not just being kind to your coworkers and being courteous and showing mutual respect. but you very seldom have those claims arise in workplaces where those dynamics have already been sort of instilled as the cultural norm. When you have people who are mutually respectful, you're not as likely to see harassment and discrimination arising. Same thing goes for a lot of the diversity and inclusion initiatives that we're seeing coming out all over the state and all over the country. And those are a wonderful resource to sort of get people more tuned in to the fact that just because you didn't intend to exclude someone or didn't intend to hurt someone's feelings or be offensive doesn't mean that you weren't. Right. Just because you may not be aware of certain privileges or certain benefits that come along with your demographic group, your history, or any of those other things doesn't mean they don't exist and doesn't mean that you shouldn't kind of take those things into account when you're interacting with both your coworkers and members of the public. One of the single biggest game changers I think I've seen in a lot of the training over the past few years has been this notion of bystander intervention training, that putting the onus on the person who's been wronged or who's been subjected to unwelcome or just sort of unpleasant workplace dynamics, the onus should not be on that person to always intervene and to say, that joke made me uncomfortable, or when you made this offhanded comment, it was really offensive to people of my religion or people of my racial or ethnic background. If we sort of empower everyone in the workforce to pull that person aside later and to validate their feelings and validate their experience by saying, you know, I saw that joke and that was not okay. If you'd like me to say something, or, you know, I'm sending you the message that if you want to say something, I don't think you would be overreacting because I also saw that and I didn't think it was all right. Or to go to the person who made the joke and say, you know what, I don't know what you were intending to do, but that was not something you should have said or done. Those sorts of dynamics have a far greater impact over time in reducing this conflict that tends to drive a lot of these unhealthy dynamics than anything that's going to be sort of delivered from on high from the supervisors and managers. Peer feedback.
Yeah, having somebody standing up for you and validating what your experience was, that would be so powerful as an employee. Yeah.
And, you know, it's less confrontational often.
Yeah.
You know, to have a coworker or a buddy say, that joke wasn't funny and you need to,
right.
Or, you know, do you have any idea what the history of that, you know, phrase that you just used means? That may not mean what you think it means. And maybe you need to go apologize to that person. Hearing that from a colleague is going to be perhaps more impactful and also less confrontational than getting called in and being written up by a manager after you've done that and a few other things several months later. So really, engaging in some of these training efforts does a lot of good for a series of reasons, but the least of which is it can actually sort of fend off a lot of these issues before they become problems.
And so, okay, so after an employee's been part of the team for a while, what can employers do to keep the focus on the work?
That'd be nice, right? The bad news is, you never get to completely relax. You never get to completely assume that everything is good, we're all fine. Because as we were saying earlier, the slightest, sort of the butterfly effect, the slightest new variable can completely upend what used to be a pleasant workplace dynamic. You can have someone who has their own personal crisis. They might be going through family problems or health problems or something like that. And it can affect how they relate to others in the workplace in a way that can trigger a whole new series of issues that you did nothing to create. You had all the right controls in place. And suddenly it seems like someone's really kind of changed what used to be a good working dynamic. But keeping your finger on the pulse of those things, engaging in regular check-ins to assess your culture and your dynamic, asking people. I mean, it never fails to amaze me how seldom I hear that employers are really going that extra step of seeking feedback. And that can be done in a bunch of ways. If you are evaluating your employees every year, which I hope you are, having your employees do their own self-evaluation beforehand to hear how they think they're doing may reveal a whole lot of kind of disconnect that needs to be addressed. Having your employees evaluate your supervisors and managers, doing kind of 360 evaluations to get a feel for whether you have that sort of person in middle management who you think hung the moon, and you find out later, oh, behind my back, they're, you know, walking around, just not managing things in a way that's very collaborative or what I would condone in any way. You know, assessing how you're communicating, whether you're following your own examples, walking the walk, and looking at how you're modeling the expected behavior for your staff can go a long way in sort of maintaining a good dynamic. When we do workplace harassment training, one of the things that I beg and plead is to say, please have every member of management sitting in that room with me. Please have every elected official sitting in that room with me. Even though I know you want this to be happening because you hired me to come do it, it sends the message that you prioritize and value the importance of this as much as you expect your employees to. In the last year, especially as workplaces are beginning to go back into in-person work, one of the big things that we're encouraging people to do is to encourage a lot of transparency and have more conversations and fewer sort of mandates and, you know, announcing, here's what we're going to be doing. You know, we're having people come back to work. Here's how it's going to be. Asking people, you know, how are you feeling about this? Do you have any anxieties? Do you have any concerns? Is there something we haven't considered? It may not change the way that you approach things at all, but offering people the kind of safety of understanding that an employer cares about their feedback and is going to take it into account, allowing those open channels of communication does so much to sort of fend off a lot of difficulties that we can often see.
Because so much of it is just the employee's perception of how things are coming across, that the employer is not fair or has favorites or isn't being consistent in assigning work or something like that. And they feel like the boss is the conflict, the boss is the problem. But, you know, I'm hearing you say that opening those lines of communication and giving them opportunities to express those views might be a good step in allowing that honesty to come through and having a professional discussion about things that come up.
I couldn't have said that better myself. That's exactly the exact dynamic that we tend to see. And I'll tell you, often we may not have any idea what someone's hangup was until we're sitting there taking their deposition, and we'll hear a laundry list of grievances from a plaintiff about all of the unremedied kind of issues happening in the workplace. And I'll often be sitting next to the manager, supervisor, elected official who employed them. And they're going, I had no idea. Like, I had no idea that this was an issue. I just know that they were really grouchy all the time and didn't get their work done. And had I known that those things were issues, that would have been so much easier to resolve than sitting here today. So Absolutely. I mean, I think having those conversations before they turn into these festering kind of series of baggage that people are carrying around does so much to encourage a better workflow and a better dynamic and to fend off the bigger conflicts as well as the smaller ones.
So if we're letting people express their conflict, what is the most productive way of doing that?
Oh, if I could answer that question with complete confidence, I'd probably be in good shape. I mean, I will tell you, I think that's going to be very dependent on the individual and the relationship and the dynamic. I can have a much more direct conversation with some people than others. With some, you know, one thing that I often will talk to judges who I represent is, you may be used to thinking, you know, if I represent someone who maybe was an assistant prosecutor or maybe a partner in a law firm before they became the judge, I have to remind them that once, especially in a one-judge court, if they walk in and think that they're going to have the same dynamic with their coworkers than they did when they were in those previous positions, they're fooling themselves. The minute they put that robe on, they become funnier and smarter, and no one ever disagrees with their ideas. It's amazing how
it's like, a miracle.
And you know, and I've had a few of them say, you know, it took me a while to really pick up on that, but now it kind of hurts my feelings. Like, you know, they're laughing at things that I say, and it was not that funny. But also, you're going to be the last one to sometimes know a lot of the drama, because people are not going to be as candid with you as they might be people who are down the chain, certainly with each other. And so being aware of those changing dynamics or the relationships, I think that's going to be important. And you may not any longer be the one who needs to address that. I mean, if you are, I love the judge who, you know, you fix it or I'll fix it, and you're not going to like the way I fix it, for some people, that may be the only way you're going to end up seeing a change. That is what we like to refer to as a high directness, high intensity form of communication, not always the place you want to start. I think you can have probably the best type of dynamic to employ before things become really problematic is to have high directness. Don't get around the bush and try to work your way into the issue, but, you know, have an unambiguous discussion about something that you perceive as an issue, but express that in a means that's not going to be intimidating or offensive or make someone feel like they have to be on guard. A lot of the very tools that we use to implement mediation, probably couples counseling, applies equally in workplaces. You know, when you talk about assuming the best from people, assuming that their intentions are good and focusing on the shared goals and values that you have, you know, you may be really going to war with someone over how you handle a process because you think that's going to be the best way to serve the public. Whereas the other person who has a different approach to doing it may have the same exact objective. And the only thing you disagree on is the means. So listening to each other with an open mind and trying to value the perspectives of someone else and try to take their perspective is not an easy thing to do. It's maybe not how we're conditionally wired to do things, but viewing, you know, those discussions as a safe place to iron it out in a way that is not going to be personal or isn't trying to attack the other person can be a very effective means of doing it. And sometimes employees can do that on their own. Very often you're going to need someone to facilitate those conversations when it's become sort of a chronic divide that is not being worked out. Yeah. And I'll say too, a lot of employers' response to, I'll try to think of an example. I mean, one that I hear frequently is clerk's offices, where there's some work that has to be done waiting on people at the counter. There's a lot of work that can be done at your desks where you're not having to interact with members of the public. Your work, the one where you're interacting with people face-to-face and dealing with every question, complaint, and problem is not usually the preferred job of all of the different jobs that deputy clerks perform. And I hear chronically, there's a lot of sparring over
who has to sit at the desk.
I handled the last three people. They don't come to the desk often enough. We don't rotate often enough. Or, you know, she's doing more than I'm doing, or I'm doing more than she's doing.
So-and-so's coming through the lobby. I'm going on break.
Exactly. And so having really frank conversations, and, you know, you would think that these would be the sorts of things that would be very easy to work out. You know, it'd be very easy as a supervisor to come in and say, okay, new policy. You handle one, then you handle one. We're going to go back and forth and we're going to make it fair. Sometimes fair is not, or equal is not equitable. And so hearing the feedback, you know, because you might hear one employee say, well, if we do it that way, I'm still going to end up with more because we have this rush during this hour. You know, if we're going to say maybe blocking it out by hour, you know, you do the first hour, you do, you know, odds and even hours rotating, that may not be the most fair. And you may not realize that as a supervisor until getting into the weeds. You also probably don't care about that as a supervisor, but if your staff does, and if it is causing a regular amount of friction, failing to address that issue has the greater tendency to turn into disputes over whose turn it is to choose their vacation time first and whether someone's taking overtime at a time that inconveniences the other and so on. Mm-hmm. So rather than just kind of swooping in and fixing the problem, really trying to have a more collaborative approach to trying to understand what the crises are, what the complaints are, and hearing your employee's perspective before announcing a solution can go a long way, especially, and the thing is you don't have to implement the solutions that they're telling you, but listening to what they want to do and why, maybe even explaining why that solution is not the best one and why you're going to go with a different alternative, but making sure that they know, I hear you, I understand you, I may not completely agree with you. And maybe the reason why is because you're not privy to a bunch of things that I kind of don't have to explain to you, but I'm going to do that anyway as a professional courtesy to help kind of pull you into the dynamic so that you understand. Does a lot to sort of open that degree of grace and understanding that we're more likely to afford each other when you have those discussions than when you just come in and say, here's what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. From now on, I don't want to hear about the desk anymore. So it's easier said than done. It's very easy for me to just tell people this is what they need to do because I don't have to do it. And, you know, don't have to figure out how to make that work in the midst of all the other things on my list. But
so I want to keep on with this topic of how to address the conflict. And obviously you talked about directives and kind of talking it out and coming up with solutions between the employees. Obviously, termination is always a drop dead way to solve a problem. But this is a podcast that often focuses on dispute resolution. So I have to ask, is formal dispute resolution an option for workplace conflicts?
Very much so. And, you know, I say that with a little asterisk next to it. First of all, I mean, the message that I continually convey to employers is that if you're doing the work of personnel management, evaluations, discipline, if you're having regular conversations about both the good and the bad that's happening with your performance in the workplace, you're very unlikely to have too many issues that rise to the level of having to result in terminations. People never believe me when I say this, but I've had so many instances where I've told employers, if you stay on this issue and you evaluate employees, you inform them about what's expected, you address issues when they're not being employed to your expectations, you enact discipline and so on, more often than not, people are going to fire themselves. They're going to leave before the inevitable severance of their employment because they see the writing on the wall. When you've told them in explicit terms, here are expectations, you're not meeting them, you need to meet them, or this is going to be something that continues to escalate. Most people don't want to wait for that to happen. They're either going to correct or they're going to leave. And I've had that conversation during the depths of the recession when employers told me, you don't understand him. This person could not find another job making this much money anywhere else. They will never leave. So we're not, you know, that's very nice and all, but it's not going to happen. And I will run into them at a seminar a couple years later and they're saying, you're never going to believe what happened. It's like, yeah, I know. So first of all, a lot of the good personnel management stuff that, you know, often tends to get taught as sort of fire insurance to keep yourself from getting sued or to put you in a good position in the event you're sued, all that documentation and communication, it really has the primary benefit of that is not litigation prevention or defense. It actually results in better run organizations and more healthy dynamics and fewer conflicts and disputes. Once you run into situations, though, that seem like they're not going to resolve without further intervention, I have seen formal dispute resolution, like actual mediation, something that looks a little bit like marriage counseling, happening in a workplace, and it can be very effective with a few caveats. Who you have do it is difficult because if you have somebody who is already known to the parties and who might be regarded as already being in one camp or another, or having kind of preordained ideas about the workplace, maybe someone in-house is not the best person to facilitate. You might need someone from outside. Also, I mean, probably the single biggest issue is that normally in mediation, we tend to think of that as sort of Vegas rules. You know, what happens in mediation stays in mediation. We don't repeat it outside these walls. We don't ever use this information against someone. If you're in a mediation and you find out the reason there's been this unhealthy dynamic is that someone perceives the other as racially hostile or sexually harassing them or something that requires you to intervene as an employer or take action, you're not going to be allowed to just pretend it didn't happen because it occurred in mediation. So you have to be very clear going into that process what the expectations are. And so making sure that people understand this is all confidential. Unless we have, you know, there are some instances where we're not permitted to keep it confidential. So avoiding retaliation can be another difficulty that arises when you're having these very difficult conversations. I've had great reports of success from employers who have used these tools. I've had a few that have not gone well at all. And usually the difference is when it was employed. So if you wait until you've already got a really fractious situation on your hands, it's far less likely to be effective than it is when you're starting to have disputes over whose turn it is to work the counter. Mm-hmm. So the timing, I think, can be the single most critical factor in how successfully those efforts play out.
Well, I think I would be remiss if I didn't talk to you about the hot topic, which is how do you see the pandemic affecting workplace dynamics? What can we expect going forward? I mean, we touched on this a bit, but like, this is a brave new world of employment.
I gotta tell you, like, everybody who talks to me about this stuff is really tired of hearing me talk about it, because like, it's an exciting time to be an employment lawyer. And while I know for actual managers and supervisors who have to deal with the realities of this stuff, it's exhausting. It's an exciting time to be a lawyer walking through all this stuff, because I really have no idea how it's going to play out. I have some ideas. I shouldn't say I have no idea. I think the biggest game changer, in addition to the fact we've all been isolated from each other and not in the same physical space, is that we're seeing a huge boom of telework, hybrid telework. A lot of employers are contemplating allowing people to come back mostly in the workplace, but maybe a day or two of working from home. That might actually make things easier and better, because people have a little bit more distance from each other. It also brings in a whole new series of shifts about work, you know, who's doing more work or how work is getting done. So in some means, it's going to be a little more work for managers to manage those expectations and make sure everybody's on the same page and is feeling the same way about these shifts. And the single biggest kind of predictor of how well all of these things are likely to work are going to be the quality and the content of the discussions you're having with your staff. Are you checking in with people? Are you taking opportunities to get them together and say, how is this working for everyone? Does anyone have complaints? Maybe having those conversations separately as well, in case they're not feeling comfortable bringing them up in front of others. But I think that's very likely to be the biggest things. We also see, you know, we thought we had a lot of things to disagree about before the pandemic. We now have entirely new categories of firmly held convictions about, you know, vaccines, about, you know, the virus itself, about whether kids should be in school, about telework. I mean, people have developed whole new categories of reasons to fall into disputes. Just gives us more practice. Kate, I think that's going to be the key, is we just have more and more opportunities to try to walk through. And if we can navigate this, it gives us all the same tools we need to navigate the others. I'm very much looking forward to hearing from employers about how that's all working out.
Me too. I'm interested to see this all play out, especially even at my workplace. I'm like, what are they going to do? There's just a lot of uncertainty. We're almost at the end of our podcast today, but there's a bit I like to do at the end of every podcast, and it's called Two for Me and One for You. There's going to be two questions for you, the presenter, and one question that you will have for our listening audience to see if they were paying attention today. So the first question is, what's an interesting and relatively brief dispute resolution or workplace conflict story you can share?
Thought about this a while, because nearly all of the ones I could share are probably going to be so obvious that anyone hearing this about them.
Protect people's names and identities.
Here is what I thought of when I thought it. So I thought about the one unifying factor that united as many of the extensive conflicts that have resulted in litigation. And I wouldn't say this has happened in every one of my cases that ultimately got filed. But if I were to kind of find one quality or one dynamic that tended to be consistent among the majority of the lawsuits that I see, which is probably the kind of pinnacle of unresolved workplace conflict, it would be sort of an inattention to the emotional intelligence factors that led up to those events. I've had situations where someone was fired via email or via a letter, when a phone call or an in-person face-to-face meeting would have been better. I've had situations where the way someone's separation was communicated either to the public or to other people in the workforce in a way that was really not necessary. You know, maybe it was gratuitous to even have to share that they were terminated when you could have just as easily relayed that they are no longer working there, or you could have given them an opportunity to resign in lieu of being terminated. You could have terminated them at the end of the day so they could clear out their office in a way that was under the radar instead of having to do it in front of their colleagues. where they might be emotional and feel embarrassed about how they were kind of asked to leave the building, or there are a whole variety of examples that I could cite to where someone's feelings were not taken into account. And make no mistake, usually by the time you're separating someone from employment, you may not really be prioritizing their feelings, because that person may have really driven you to the point of frustration over and over, and you've just had it. I think if employers think about the perspectives of their employees at all times along the continuum, including when that relationship ends, we would see fewer cases. And I feel that way because when I'm often taking someone's deposition and I expect to hear a whole series of complaints about how they were treated, you know, if it's a workplace harassment case and they're talking about the examples, when I'm hearing more about how their employment ended or things that really don't have anything to do with harassment, but I'm hearing more about unfairness and a lack of transparency and a lack of sort of that feeling that they weren't listened to on a variety of other things that aren't legally actionable, I'm not at all surprised. I tend to see a lot of workplace discord or feelings of sort of unresolved conflict that aren't legally actionable kind of manifest their way into litigation, pled as claims that are actionable, because those are the only ones that you can use to bring a claim. So I suspect that the best insurance toward avoiding sort of the worst conflicts that can happen are just to pay attention to those little things, pay attention to whose turn it is to work the counter, or who's going to schedule their vacation in a way that doesn't conflict with the others, because those things have a way of sort of escalating into much bigger dynamics.
That's a good advice. All right. Well, who is an amazing person related to fields of dispute resolution, workplace conflict, and why do you appreciate them?
I struggle with this too. I struggle to pick just one. I will tell you the best thing I've listened to lately or watched lately that I thought was so outstanding. I sent legitimate fan mail to the provider of this CLE, but Jocelyn Armstrong, who is the director of inclusion and outreach. I think they actually have a whole series at the OSBA on a variety of issues relating to diversity and inclusion. She and Kwame Christian, who is the director of the American Negotiation Institute, put on a Q&A sort of podcast. Actually, I think it was a webinar called How to Have a Difficult Conversation About Race. And it is completely free, I think actually both to members and to non-members. And I just pulled it up online last night to make sure it was still around and still available. But it is an hour of professional conduct credit for free and truly one of the best things I've heard or listened to in a very long time, not just about all of the issues that are so critical right now for employers to be wrapping their heads around, about sort of looking at race and diversity in a different way, but really, and this should not be surprising that it had benefits that went beyond this, because I believe Kwame is also sort of a master mediator in his own right.
He is. He was on the podcast, episode 4.
I'm an official super fan. Like, I've got to tell you, I know Jocelyn, so I emailed her, but I would be like effusively like fangirling if I had called Kwame, because it was truly one of the best things I've seen in a very long time. But he went through a whole series of ways to address diversity and inclusion in a way that ensured that you would actually have some productive conversations. And I told Jocelyn, the thing I liked about it most is I felt like I had been saturated in resources very much like this over the past year. I've been teaching resources like this for employers. And yet watching this, I felt like I had something new that I could pull from it, even though I thought I had read a whole lot about it already. And yet I felt like it was a very unintimidating and non-threatening platform that you could show someone who has not looked at this in the slightest yet and really communicate it in a way that they would understand and find sort of helpful in understanding why are we even talking about this. I mean, I think what the single biggest benefit of that program had been was to relay how to be more effective with people who maybe don't think that that information is even relevant to them or don't have an opinion that this is especially important, and getting them to understand that through I believe what he called a compassionate curiosity framework of just trying to get people on the same page. And a lot of those tools that he discussed while they were discussing them in the framework of getting people aligned on issues of race and inclusion could be applied to literally anything, any sort of workplace dynamic. So basically listen to it once just to take in everything that they're saying about race and diversity, and then listen to it again and apply it toward everything else because it was just that good.
Oh, so, good resource.
It was fabulous.
Your turn to give the audience a knowledge check. What's a pop quiz question they should be able to answer after listening to this podcast?
I think the pop quiz question would be, are there opportunities or are there instances where conflict should be initiated or issues should be called out in a way that addresses or maybe escalates conflict in order to resolve issues in the workplace?
All right. Good one. Okay. Any closing words before we sign off today?
I don't think so. Although I'll tell you, I'll be interested to see in another 6 months or in another year how much all of this has changed. So I may be coming back in another year and tell you, never mind.
Yeah.
We're all different. Like, it's fine.
We'll have an update, podcast update. That'll be amazing.
We're all exclusively communicating through instant message. Workplace dynamics are no longer
right. a thing. No longer so. A thing.
Thank you for having me on. This is great.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, that's a wrap for today. Huge thank you to Kimberly Vanover Riley for providing employers and managers with a thoughtful approach to addressing workplace conflict. And thank you to all of you listening. I hope you will join us for our next episode of the Civility and Solutions podcast. Until then, keep working for justice.